The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And if I may have your patience a little bit longer, I'd like to make a few announcements also. One is that we have this wonderful, once a year in November, this we call it Teen Retreat, my Introduction to Mindfulness and Buddhism for Teens, that we've been doing for many years now, that was initially, or it's always been asked by the Menlo School that we put on, because in ninth grade, they study world religions, and they want, they'd like to do field trips to the religions they're studying, and November is Buddhism month. So we have something like somewhere between sometimes 40 to 60 ninth graders who come here. And it's and then we usually have other teens who come and just come to be part of it because it's open to anyone. And it's quite a wonderful event. And it's said that I'm teaching it. This year I'm not teaching it, but Rebecca Ladine is going to teach it. And Rebecca has been the family teacher for family retreats and teen retreats at Spirit Rock for a number of years, and she's a wonderful teacher. We're still looking for someone to manage that day. If anyone wants to get a bird's eye view, not a bird's eye view, but an inside view of what happens when you teach mindfulness and Buddhism to a big group of teens, it's a fascinating thing to watch. And so let me know if you're interested in that, managing it. And the reason that I'm not going to do it is because next Saturday and Sunday we're having the open house for our new retreat center. And so on Saturday I'll go down there and be there to receive people for the open house. And the big kind of announcement is that we now have a retreat center. And it was quite something because I was there on Monday and Tuesday to kind of help set up. Monday, the place was still a mess. And the contractors were there and it was wood and stuff, kind of all kinds of stuff all over the place. I said, how is this going to be a retreat center by Wednesday? And by Tuesday, it looked a lot better. The contractors were cleaning up. And I said, how is it going to be a retreat center tomorrow? And then we showed up tomorrow, Wednesday, today, that day, and then, in a wonderfully miraculous way, we turned it into a retreat center. And by Wednesday evening, we started our retreat. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we had a retreat there for kind of an experimental retreat. We invited people who didn't need to have it be a retreat if it all fell apart, and it was quite one of the great experiences of my life, I think, in terms of this practice, was to see this building be turned into a retreat center for the first time. The first time we sat there as a group of people, and to kind of take a shell, something we've been trying to create for years, and actually have it manifest as a retreat center, and kind of one of the high points for me personally was by Friday, sitting there. I wasn't a teacher for the retreat. I sat the retreat. There was no real teacher for the retreat, as you usually are. And then it dawned on me at some point, I really want to come back here on retreat. This is a great retreat center. And in fact, we now have this fantastic retreat center. It exceeds my expectation of what we would have and what we create. And this beautiful, very quiet, still meditation hall that looks out over the trees, and great single rooms for people, and great hallways, and great kind of, it's just a great place. So it's a kind of monumental step for IMC, our community, that we should have this now in place. And the contractors will be back tomorrow, because now we've been there, we see, well, wait a minute, this doesn't work, and this window doesn't open, it's broken. And so it was kind of a wonderful trial to see, what needs more attention. So over the next couple of weeks, there'll be the finishing touches. And then in 2 weeks, we have our first kind of 7-day regular retreat. But it was really a delight to be there. And I think the only person who's here today besides me that was there was probably Victor. Oh, Richard, I didn't see you. He was the manager. So he was really a big part responsible for managing, making it work. So if perhaps they're available afterwards, if you want to check in with them about their perspective or what it was like. It was a wonderful event. So, carpooling is really important. So if those of you who want to go see it on Saturday, it's a great thing to see this event. But it'd be really important to carpool. And I think there's a carpool system to help you with that on the Insight Retreat Center website, right? And so we please ask you to try your best because the parking is limited. And we can't really park on the roads around there. It doesn't really work. And we certainly don't want to alienate our neighbors so early in the process. So hopefully we can figure out a carpool system, enough people that way. So the last two Sundays I was here, I gave talks about karma, and so I'd like to continue with that today. And since I'm talking about retreat centers, it's one of the great karmas in Buddhism is to create the monastery. So this community, that's many of you have been involved in supporting that make happen. And if you're in the karma ledger business, you have created really good karma for yourself and for the community and for our world here. But there is a certain approach, a way of some people understand the Buddhist idea of karma that's kind of a ledger system. In fact, you find people go around with these karma books and you go visit temples and do good deeds and the monastery would put a stamp in your little karma passport and then some people are buried, you know, with their little passport just to make sure that whoever's keeping the ledger, you have the backup to show. Which I don't believe is what the Buddha had in mind when he taught the teachings on karma. It's kind of a way that it kind of morphed into for some people. But the teaching of karma lays at the heart of what the Buddha was teaching, and the Four Noble Truths can be seen as a variation or expression of the teachings on karma. So I'd like to continue today with this theme. So the word karma literally means action. It's many times used in English to refer to the results of your actions. It's my karma that I won the lottery. It's my karma that my car was stolen. And that was the result of what I did in the past. But there's a different word in Buddhism for results. It's vipaka, which means, or it's phala. So it's the result or the fruit of the actions you've done. But the focus on the Buddhist teachings on the word karma and action is not so much focused on the results that you experience because of your past actions, but rather the focus is on taking responsibility and care for the actions that you engage in. And the focus on mindfulness practice is also to get us into the present moment so that in the present moment we can take more responsibility for the actions we choose to act on, both our actions of speech, actions of body, and actions of our mind, what we do with ourselves. And so the emphasis on karma in Buddhism is not to kind of feel bad because, or to assume that I now have cancer because of my bad karma. I must have really bad karma. And some people feel kind of takes on this kind of burden of responsibility because of bad things happen to them. It must be because of this bad karma I have. And that kind of equation is pretty much absent in the Buddhist teachings. The emphasis, again, as I said, is to help us to understand how important it is to be responsible to care for the actions we have today, because those will have consequences in the future. So in the time of the Buddha, there were many different teachings about action and their consequences, the efficacy of actions, the importance of actions. And the Buddha was one among many different spiritual teachers and many different approaches to action. One of the more popular ones seems to be that what happens to us in our lives is a consequence of the actions of the gods. And so then what's important, the actions that's important for us to do, is to have ritual offerings, sacrifices and offerings to the gods, do rituals that would please the gods, because if the gods are pleased, they might allow us to have long life or to let our crops grow well, and such things. In fact, the word karma, scholars have pointed out the earliest use of the word karma was literally meant ritual action, because the ritual actions where you kind of want to please the gods was so important. And so when the Buddha adopted the word karma, it had a kind of religious connotation to it, or emphasis to it, so a little bit more than just neutral word action. There was also the people in the time of the Buddha who believed that everything was predetermined. So what we're experiencing today was predetermined in the distant past, and it's invariable, and there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to go along for the ride. It's all been set in motion, and even if you think that you're deciding for yourself, that was decided in the past, and you're not really deciding for yourself in the past. It was just that's what was preordained, and so there's nothing you can do. So you might as well not, do anything special. Just go along and do it what you want. It doesn't matter. And part of that notion was people who said there's no right or wrong. There's no evil and there's no good. None of those have any consequences. You might as well kill randomly or freely because it's not going to have any impact on you. And then there were people who similarly believed that had nihilistic beliefs that no matter what you did, it wasn't that everything was predetermined, but everything you did had no consequence, no real consequence. And so there was no fruit of action. There's nothing happening to the future. And certainly there'd be no consequence in the next lifetime. So you might as well, as you're dying, you might as well overcharge your credit card. Because, you're not only taking the money with you, you're not taking the debt with you. And so there were kind of teachings, the nihilist teachings. So what I'm trying to say, there was a variety of different approaches to all this, all approaches which I think are not so distant from ways that modern people might also approach actions and their consequences, the reasons why things happen to us. There are people who attribute it to gods. There are people who attribute it to some other place, other people outside. What happens to us is other people's responsibility and the causes and conditions. There are people who feel that there's no real consequence of any import, certainly no long-lasting consequence. So you can do things with immunity from any kind of consequence or fruit in the future. And then there are people, so the Buddha's teachings on karma, on action, is that actions are consequential. And the actions that you choose to make are consequential. And now this seems like a pretty unimportant teaching because it's something most of us live by all the time. That if you decide if you're hungry and you want to do something about your hunger in the morning and you go into your kitchen and find food there, then making that food for yourself to satisfy your hunger is something you can do. You can act a certain way and can have a consequence. Pretty ordinary. I mean, much of the activity of our life is based on the idea that our actions are going to have consequences that we want. The consequences, so I think in the time of the Buddha, people lived that way as well. The issue is not so much, getting breakfast made. The issue for the Buddha was how can we be happy? How can we live a life where we feel some profound sense of well-being or peace in our life? Who's responsible for our happiness? Who's responsible for our peace? And for this, the Buddha basically said that you are. It's not the gods. It's not predetermined. And it's not that whatever you do has no consequences, but rather what you do in terms of your own peace, your own liberation, your own freedom, inner freedom, is something that only you can take responsibility for. And so how do you do that? Is by beginning to bring your attention to take care for your actions, what you say, body, speech, and mind, what you do. And because those are consequential, those carry momentum into the future. So for example, I could go to some other city far away for a short visit, and I could do something which makes someone happy or someone unhappy. I could, for example, take a taxi maybe and offer a big tip at the end. And the person says, that's great, thank you. And what you don't know is that my child is in the hospital and this big tip actually makes a difference for me because I'm really struggling right now. And it does make a difference, but for that person maybe, in a little way, but maybe after a few weeks that person has forgotten you. But it had made a difference, that it had a certain consequence in that town. But when you come home, it might be that you remember, I was inspired to be generous to this person, and I made a difference. And there's a certain kind of gladness that continues in your life that encourages you that maybe it's useful to be more generous in the future. It's kind of like reinforces the idea of generosity. There's a momentum in that act of generosity in terms of the memory of the good you did and the inspiration to do it again that continues in your own mind. So the consequences of that good act had a consequence in the immediacy of maybe helping that family a little bit, but it also could have a consequence in your mind that persists over a long time. My colleague James Berez loves to tell the story of someone on retreat giving him a slice of cheesecake. They don't usually give cheesecake on retreats. It's unlikely at IRC, at a retreat center. But some person on staff or something knew that his favorite dessert was cheesecake. So he showed up, and there was a cheesecake at dinner with his name on it, a little slice, a big slice or something. And he looked at that cheesecake, and he knew that he would really enjoy eating it. But what he did was he cut it up into a lot of small pieces, like bite-sized pieces, and then left it on, a dozen or so bite-sized pieces on little plates so the other retreatants could take one of those plates and enjoy one bite of cheesecake. And then he went and sat in the back of the dining room and watched as people came in, saw the cheesecake, were delighted, those first 12, I guess, and sat down and savored. Because this is a three-month retreat, so if you're sitting in silence, the ability to savor something good is like exponentially compared to daily life. So they took their bite, and he could watch the delight and the happiness of people. And then when he teaches this in his Dharma talks, he says that the sensual pleasure that I could have had from eating that cheesecake for myself, selfishly, just for myself, it was meant for me after all, that would have lasted that meal. The joy that he received from watching people enjoy what he gave away, that lasted for years as a memory. So the idea that you could have consequences here and now in the kind of external world like that, and you can also have consequences in your own mind, is the distinction that the Buddha wants to make. And what happens in your mind, in terms of your consequences for your happiness and peace, that's really consequential. You want to caretake for what are the actions that you do that are consequential in your own mind. So there are actions that you can do, and some of you might do these things, which are not beneficial for you. There are people, there's a whole, I think we have an epidemic of people who are addicted and a variety of different things that people can be addicted to. I suspect that this is a modern illness in a way that never was the case in the past. I mean, I'm sure there were people who were addicted to things in the past, but there's something about the modern condition of life, what's available to us, that I think the opportunities to get addicted have grown exponentially. And it's a real big illness in the modern world. And some of you who maybe been involved in addictive behavior or on the edges of it, and I suspect that almost everyone has a computer, has seen a little bit the consequences of this, that you get involved a little bit too much searching the web or doing things, and you kind of not or email or something, and it's not so easy to get off, or it's not so easy to not be kind of concerned with it. And you can feel that after you've been on it for a little while, too long, you feel kind of drained or numbed out or spinning. I've noticed sometimes an addictive quality where if I stay too long on the computer, I just keep wanting to do it. Like, one more email, please. Let me check that one. You know, and I can see that it's detrimental to myself, and kind of physically, and kind of feel getting tired or a little bit numb. But the idea that there's certain behavior, then addictive behavior, which creates conditions not only that are detrimental in the present moment, but reinforce that kind of addictive behavior in the future. And so this is an example of how what we do with our mind has impact on our inner well-being. So for the Buddha, karma, the teachings on karma, are encouragements for us to look at what we're doing and evaluate it based on whether this is going to be helpful for our inner happiness and inner well-being. And if that's what we want. And so in this regard, one of the really important key pieces of this is the intention behind which we do things. What is the intention behind what we say, what we do, and even the intentions behind what we think? And so part of Buddhist spirituality, is part of the function of mindfulness, is to be mindful enough that we can begin the custom, the practice of checking in, what is my intention in saying this? What's my intention in doing this? What's my intention in having these kinds of thoughts? You're not off the hook karmically just because you're thinking it. Even thinking something regularly carries momentum in the mind. It creates a habit in the mind. It creates a memory of this. It creates certain kind of momentum. So if you're thinking thoughts of goodwill to people, even people who hate you, that's going to create very different conditions in your own mind than if you have intentions of hating the people that hate you. Now, it can seem quite reasonable that you should hate people who hate you. It's justified, isn't it? And you don't want to let them get away with it. So you might as well meet hate with hate. But if you do that, you're creating a very different inner landscape, inner ecology, than if you meet the hate with love, with kindness, with generosity, with equanimity, with patience, with non-reactivity. Even maybe sometimes all you can do is walk away. Creates a very different condition. So what are some of the key inner intentions that the Buddha encouraged and discouraged? There was three in particular that he put a lot of stress on as part of the Eightfold Path. The first is avoiding intentions of lust. Maybe I talked about this last time I was here. So not having lust. Oh, no, I talked about it on Monday night, a couple of weeks ago. And someone came up to me afterwards and says, uh-oh. You mean that... the person said, I'm attracted to someone, and we're starting to date and stuff, and I feel the sexual attraction, and, is this a problem? And what I suggested was that sexual attraction is a normal part of life, but if that's the only reason to go into bed, I think that maybe that's not a good foundation for a lasting relationship. And the person seemed to want a lasting relationship. So what is the primary intentions we're operating on under? And if it's a relationship like a romantic relationship, I would hope that there are other intentions besides lust operating, even if lust is there. But if it's the only one, watch out. because that probably might come back and bite you. So one of the things the Buddha cautioned people against was operating primarily under intentions of lust. The other is intentions of ill will. If you have ill will for other people, you're creating if the opposite of well-being is ill-being, you're creating ill-being for yourself. It's very consequential to have a mind full of ill will. And so there's a tremendous emphasis in Buddhism to go back and care for that mind, not to dwell in a mind of ill will. You create bad karma if you have ill will for your ill will. So you have to be very careful. If you find yourself filled with hate, not to then dump on yourself for that or feel bad about yourself for doing that. There's a generosity in this practice where, even though you're trying to not to have ill will, you're not kind of burdening yourself with guilt or heaviness because that you have it. It's a human thing to have it. It's easier to overcome it if you don't burden yourself with guilt and, you know, self-criticism for having it. And then the third is, usually translated into English as cruelty. Ill will is kind of like, I wish the tires in that person's car go flat, you know, or something, you know, I wish that, you know, you have this ill will that the person, you know. But cruelty is, you know, is more like, I want to, you know, I'm going to punch that person out when I see the person. I'm going to poke the tires out. I think that's what it means. And the word is himsa, and himsa is the opposite of ahimsa. Some of you know ahimsa as being nonviolence. So himsa usually, but that's the situation to be considered violence. So wishing to cause harm. So those are three intentions that the Buddha cautioned us, saying these are intentions. If we act on them in any kind of way, set in motion conditions in the mind or in the heart, which are not conducive to inner peace, inner well-being, inner happiness. They might be conducive to a certain kind of pleasure, most obviously with lust. But for some people, ill will, anger, is energizing in a way that's very pleasant for them. That's part of the motivation for it. but the difference here is between pleasure and happiness. The opposite of these are the three kinds of intentions which the Buddha encouraged as part of the path of practice. And they're kind of like the opposites of the wrong intentions. So the opposite of himsa is ahimsa. It's usually in English translated as, in Buddhist English, as non-cruelty here, but dedication to non-violence, to non-harming. To have that as an intention, as a dedication, not necessarily for the sake of the other person, but certainly for your own sake, if you want to create the right conditions in your own mind. And then for the opposite of ill will is goodwill, metta. Is the having loving kindness for people. And then the opposite, the antonym for lust, is what do you think the antonym for lust is in English? Anybody have any suggestions for it?
Letting go.
Letting go. What?
Love.
Love? Well, that's loving. That's the third. That's what's like loving kindness, right? Maybe. So maybe love. So other ideas of what the antonym might be.
Attachment.
Detachment.
Generosity.
Renunciation. What?
Equanimity.
Did someone I heard?
Aversion.
The opposite of lust is aversion. Yeah, it would be a certain kind of antonym opposite. It's true, but I think that what the Buddha was looking for was something that is. More obviously a good quality. Aversion might be good. Sometimes there's healthy turning away. Aversion means turning away. But I think often colloquial English, aversion has a quality of ill will in it.
Cooling the flames.
What?
Cooling the flames.
Cooling the flames. Calm.
Friendship.
That's nice. What?
Peace.
So a lot of possibilities. Some of you, you know, maybe knew what the Buddhist answer was. Usually in English, the word is translated as renunciation. And the word is nikkhamma, nikkhamma means a little bit more like going forth. A monastic person goes forth from the lay life into the monastic life. And the focus a little bit more on renunciation in Buddhism. There is a tremendous emphasis on letting go, renunciation. But I think the emphasis is not on what you are depriving yourself of, but rather of what you gained in letting go. So if you let go of lust, maybe what you gain is peace. If you let go of ill will, maybe what you gain is a capacity for loving kindness. If you let go of attachment, you gain all kinds of things. So list, you know, the peace of non-attachment. So the word is nikkhamma, and it's kind of a wordplay, because the word for lust is kamma, and even though they're not etymologically connected, there was kind of a little wordplay between them as the antonym, and so the renunciation of lust, the drive for sensual pleasure, is the kind of the antonym that's offered here. And I think of it as someone said, letting go. It's hard to be peaceful. It's hard to have a lot of happiness if you're clinging to things, and whether it's sensual pleasure or almost anything else. And so the intention, the desire, the motivation to let go, to not be holding tight, is really crucial if what you want is to be peaceful and to be happy. If what you want is to protect your own things at all possible costs, then maybe clinging is a good idea. But the part of that cost will be, you'll be miserable. So the intentions you have had consequences. They condition the mind, they shape the mind, your mind is the mind is plastic. Nerve pathways can be changed. So what we do, the intentions we act on, shape the mind, and we can be responsible for that shape. As the mind gets shaped, that sets the conditions for how we're going to respond to things in the future. So if we've shaped the mind to be generous, if we shape the mind, if we develop those neural pathways so that we can be loving, then we're much more likely to act that way in the future when we enter into a new situation. If we develop the opposite of those are neural pathways that developed, then, you know, we end up more likely wanting to be angry in situations that provoke us. It also affects our memories. You know, the memories we carry have an impact on us because they come back and visit us. And the people on retreat will find this a lot. That especially really good memories of good things you've done and really terrible things you've done, they'll return on retreat because unresolved things or powerful things we've done have a tendency to surface. People think they've been off the hook for 30 years. And I've known people who sat down to meditate on retreat and, and then they have to live with that karma or live with that memories for a while and work through it. So the emphasis of karma teachings, as I understand it, is mostly psychological. That the concern of karma is our inner psychology and how that inner psychology plays itself out. It's not about the cause and effect in the world itself, though it's not completely separate, these two worlds. So we're concerned about the effects our behavior have in the world, that affects our intentions, our memories, and things like that. But the primary kind of channel for the working of karma is the psychological byways and causeways of our mind and our hearts. So we would become the caretakers of those byways and causeways and set the conditions so that we can create a mind that can more easily be peaceful and happy. Some Buddhists, I know practitioners, are a little bit more like little magical thinking about happiness and peace. They think that if only I can have this, you know, the Big Bang experience of enlightenment, then everything else will take care of itself. And for some people who have that kind of view of Buddhism, then they don't take responsibility for caretaking for their own mind, because they're waiting for that great experience in the future which is going to do it. And I think that the approach of the Buddha is to be the caretaker of your own mind, and in doing that, not to have a Big Bang experience of enlightenment, but to gradually grow into it, grow into the experience of enlightenment. And it's a very mature way to kind of allow yourself to kind of grow and develop into this. The last thing I'll say is that in this talk, I've emphasized that the teachings of karma are mostly concern yourself, caring for your own mind, your own intentions, and how it's going to affect you. I think that's the emphasis the Buddha had for karma, but it wasn't the emphasis of how the Buddha stressed action in the world. When we're choosing how to live in the world, it seemed like his emphasis was to equally focus on what's beneficial for oneself and what's beneficial for others. The Buddha distinguished between people who don't do anything good for others or for themselves, those who only do good for others and not for themselves, those who only do good for themselves and not for others, and then the fourth category is those who do good, benefit both self and others. And the people who benefit both self and others are considered the wise people. When the Buddha defined who's wise, he said it's those who benefit self, others, and both self and others. And so I think that even though the karma teachings about caring for yourself, when you've managed to care for yourself, you become a person who will then care equally for the world around you and for yourself. And I hope that's the case. I hope that this practice that we teach is one that creates a wide community of folks who have the greater good on their mind. So I hope that made some sense. I think you have a chance to create really good karma very quickly if you turn to the person next to you, and even if you've never been here before, this is your first time here, welcome them to IMC. And introduce yourself and just have a very short, warm greeting before the potluck.